Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Scorsese brings us a startling vision. An extraordinary story. The last temptation of Christ.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me from the snowy slopes of the Rockies is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Well, it won't be the Sermon on the Mount, but I'll do my best.
We'll do our best to spread the good news with this episode. This week, just in time for Easter, we're talking about The Last Temptation of Christ. Released in 1988, this controversial film from Martin Scorsese was based on the 1953 novel by Nikos Kazantzakis.
Nikos Kazantzakis.
Yes, and adapted by frequent Scorsese collaborator Paul Schrader. The film examines the life of Jesus, paying special attention to his life on earth as a man, not necessarily as a holy divine creature. We see Jesus tormented and suffering, tortured as he tries to deny his role in God's plan. So, Rob, what has been your history with The Last Temptation?
Well, I remember The Last Temptation of Christ when it first came out. I was only about 10 then, so 1988, and I remember the stuff that was on the news and the protests and all of that stuff. And my dad at the time had been part of a group in Detroit, an atheist freethought group, that went and saw it. And I remember just sort of, you know, the conversation around the house or whatever was on the news. And really didn't think much of it because, I mean, I was only 10 years old at the time, although the year before my dad did show me Clockwork Orange. So maybe not the best dad, you know, don't show a 9-year-old Clockwork Orange, kids. But anyway, I eventually got into Last Temptation and watching it, I would say, when I became a completist about Martin Scorsese, when I got into high school. He was one of these filmmakers who I had seen his stuff. And at the time, Casino had come out and was in the theaters when I was in high school. And I went back and I watched everything, you know, Goodfellas and Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, everything I could get my hands on. And of course, you're going to come across Last Temptation of Christ at some point. But actually, it was kind of hard to get at the time, unless you went to an independent video store. That was because Blockbuster wouldn't carry it.
So what'd you think of it when you finally saw it?
Well, I really liked it. I mean, for me, obviously raised in a household where I have been a non-believer my entire life, I actually find the film to be very human and very humanist about how this character that we know from the culture in which we live in America, whether you like it or not, you're going to be brought into the ideas of the Bible and especially the New Testament and Christianity. I think it's really interesting how it shows a person who's struggling to figure out his place within the world. And I think that anyone can kind of come to an understanding of what that's like. And especially even more so when we talk about this character and this person of Jesus and how if he was called by God and not only that, but part of God, but man at the same time, how he would have that conflict within himself. And I think that's really a fascinating thing to discuss and a fascinating thing that about this film. And also from what I understand about the book, I have not read the book.
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult book to read. I am still not done with it. I started it, probably like 2 months ago. And I read a little bit and my eyes just kind of glaze over and I'm like, yeah, I'm really tired. I'm going to put this down and go to sleep now.
But you're in good company, because even Paul Schrader on the commentary on the Criterion DVD says it's not really a book that's fun to read. He's like, it's actually more about ideas than it is about plot or story.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe it was the translation or something, or maybe it's just that way, you know, because it was translated from German, even though Nikos is obviously with that handle, he's Greek, but he wrote it in German and it was translated from that. So it's like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe it was just as kind of, I won't say dull, but definitely didn't really have me engaged fully while I was reading it. And I you know, it's not the subject matter necessarily, because I've actually read quite a few books about this Jesus Christ guy. And, you know, usually I'm fairly engaged unless I start getting like really super off the deep end when it comes to, you know, the whole idea of spiritualism and the Father, Son, Holy Ghost and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes it gets a little much when you kind of get into the way that the Christians try to explain some of the conflicting information that are in the Bible and everything. But it was tough. It was interesting, though. I definitely want to finish it, but it's not something that I'm going to be able to finish off by, say, next Tuesday. So I'm not going to put it down just because we're recording this episode now. I will continue reading it.
As for the plot itself, I think that really, in a way, it says in the beginning of the film that it's not based on the Gospels, but I would say that it follows the main sort of plot line of the Gospels, especially from maybe sort of his understanding of what he's supposed to do going forward. So what we call roughly the Jesus years, so age 34, 35, whatever, he's the carpenter and then sort of moving forward. So do you want to get into the plot and sort of where this goes?
I don't want to be a dick about this, but I want to say he was supposed to have died when he was 33. So hopefully it's not years 34 and 35, because those would get a little boring.
Okay.
It's so funny that you and I are the ones talking about this movie, because we have no secrets that you and I are both, basically, we've been raised atheist, and here we are talking about this, but we have both absorbed so much. You made the point about we live in this Christian culture, and there's no way that anybody who's even trying to actively be an atheist can walk away without kind of having absorbed all this stuff just from what we hear, what we see every day. It's weird too, like, you know, you find out that some of the things that we've learned are in the Bible, and some of these are like these kind of like quasi-biblical notions that really aren't written down any place, but, you know, they're kind of out there in the culture as far as being this kind of part of Christianity overall. I guess, you know, even though the Bible was kind of set in stone, as it were, I'm trying to remember which council it was, but they said, okay, these are the X number of books of the New Testament, but there's still all the other books and the other Gospels and the other, you know, Apocrypha that kind of have informed the whole Christianity overall, all the stories of the saints and all these kind of things that, gosh, there's just so much out there and we're just inundated with it every day.
Well, what's really interesting about this film is that you have a book by Greek Orthodox that was taken to heart by a Catholic and then adapted by a Dutch Calvinist. So you really get a broad range of the three main ideas of Christianity in a lot of ways coming through this film. I mean, you have the Eastern versus the Western view of Christ, and then also sort of the division within the Western Christianity between the Protestants and the Catholics. So it's really interesting that you have these people with this diversified background. As for myself, I've gotten into, you know, screaming matches with friends of mine who are atheists and believe that you should not, if you're an atheist, there's no reason for you to read the Bible. I disagree. I think that if you're going to be a critic of anything, you have to understand what you're criticizing. And not only that, if you're living in the Western culture, there's so much stuff that comes from it in terms of even figures of speech and things that people use. I mean, if you didn't understand that David and Goliath was an idea of a small man versus a giant, then when someone says to you, yeah, you know, it was a real David Goliath situation, you wouldn't understand what they're talking about. So while I don't believe that this is a book that inspires me in my life in that way, I do find various interesting things within it. And I do find that this film, for me, Last Temptation of Christ, is a very human film. And I've never really had a problem with being someone who's a non-believer and saying, you know what, I got no problem with this being around. My problem comes, and I think I would say much the same with you without getting into a large political rant, is that I don't like the idea of people mandating their morality upon us based on their religious faith, because I think that's very dangerous and can lead to things like what we saw with the purgings in Europe or even something like Iran or Afghanistan. And I think we have to be very careful with that. I think church-state separation is an important thing. It allows everyone to make up their own minds in terms of what's important for them in their lives. And we also have to remember that in America, church-state separation was not created by a bunch of atheists. It was actually created by a very devout man, Roger Williams, and you can read more about him and the founding of Providence, Rhode Island, and that when he was thrown out of the Massachusetts colony for not following the orthodoxy.
It's funny. I have a feeling that this episode is going to have a rather large bibliography attached to it.
So let's get into the plot and into the film a little bit more.
If we begin with Jesus as probably, I don't know, 26, 27 years old, maybe a little bit later in his life. I mean, the whole idea was that he was supposed to have started really kind of preaching around age 30. And we get him kind of on the cusp of that. And he is trying everything he can to basically make the voices in his head stop. He has been plagued for his entire life by visions, by voices, by ideas, not knowing what he is, what he's supposed to do. And he tries everything that he can to basically make God leave him alone, make him, he has embraced as many sins as he possibly can. He's even gone so far that he's making crosses for the Romans to crucify people that the people in the community, his Jewish brethren, believe are the new Messiah.
God loves me. I know he loves me. I want him to stop. I can't take the pain, the voices and the pain. I want him to hate me. I fight him. I make crosses so he'll hate me. I want him to find somebody else. I want to crucify every one of his messiahs.
We begin with one incident where we have a zealot that some people are considering the new messiah, and he's there making this cross for them, and he's confronted by Judas fairly early in the film. Judas, for me, always kind of gets a bad rap. You know, it depends on which version of history you're reading, but there's this whole idea that Judas is Christ's best friend, at least in this film, very much. He is his kind of his best buddy after they kind of come to terms that Jesus is trying to follow God as best as he can, and really he wants Judas there to almost keep him on the straight and narrow.
One of the things that I find interesting within the film, and this is a recurrent thing that basically goes all the way through, I would say almost till the end, is that the character played by Willem Dafoe of Jesus is very much a man struggling and understanding that he feels himself to be a coward.
I'm a liar. A hypocrite. I'm afraid of everything. I don't ever tell the truth. I don't have the courage. When I see a woman, I blush and look away. I want her, but I don't take her for God, and that makes me proud. And then my pride ruins Magdalene. I don't steal, I don't fight, I don't kill, not because I don't want to, but because I'm afraid. I want to rebel against you, against everything, against God, but I'm afraid.
And just how someone who comes to knowledge or someone who comes to this understanding that's being put into them by this divine presence in some way, being tortured by it, as he says, and we hear the sound of an eagle from time to time, and he talks about the idea of claws sort of digging into him, reaching into his head and giving him these headaches, that he just can't get to a place of comfort within himself where he feels like he knows what he's doing. He knows he's doing the right thing, or he's trying to follow some path. He just can't kind of stand up on his own two feet. And I think that Harvey Keitel's character as Judas at one point in the beginning says, look, you know, you're going to follow the path. And if you don't, then I will kill you.
I came this close to killing him myself.
And that's what we need to talk about at some point. We do need to talk about the characterization of Harvey Keitel as Judas. And sort of, if you listen to his delivery, it's almost the same delivery in Reservoir Dogs. It's so close. Just the rhythms, especially within the part where he's yelling at him and he's like, "You're a Jew killing Jews," and that whole thing. It almost sounds exactly the same as when he's yelling at Mr. Pink and going, "I'm sorry I told him my name. What was I supposed to do?" It's the same rhythm. It's amazing.
"The Romans can't find anybody to make crosses except for you. You do it. What the fuck was I supposed to do? Tell them I'm sorry? I can't give out that fucking information. You're worse than them. It's against the rules. You're a Jew killing Jews! I don't trust you enough! You're a coward!"
I think that you and I are both very familiar with the whole idea of the Passion Play, you know, the last 7 days of Christ, and you kind of get that kind of leading up to it, and you get those notes that you get a lot. You know, you got Jesus going in to the temple and chasing out the money changers. You've got Jesus performing this miracle or that miracle. You know, is it going to be the water into wine, the loaves into fishes?
Lazarus, raising Lazarus.
Which is really kind of a creepy scene. I loved it in this one. It was like, oh, okay, Lazarus doesn't come out of the tomb and just, like, you know, wipes in his eyes going, "Oh boy, what happened?" It's like Lazarus comes out and he's kind of effed up from that. And I don't blame him.
Well, I mean, you were dead for a couple days. I mean, come on.
And he's looking all creepy and it's like the flesh on his hands and stuff.
This is the thing that I really love about The Last Temptation of Christ, is that if you go back and you're a kid and you see, I don't know, the robe, Quo Vadis, even Ben-Hur, whatever, all those epics, they're very clean. All those big Christ films or sort of Roman epic films, they're all very clean. And the thing that's really nice about The Last Temptation of Christ is you can feel the heat, you can feel the dust, the sweat, the blood, all of it's here. And that's what I really like about it is Scorsese's like, no, they would have been dirty. They would have been living in this place. There would have been dust and all of this stuff. And it really adds this level of discomfort and grit that you feel when you're watching it. And I think that in a way that's kind of, he took the idea of the New York grit that he puts in the films, in the contemporary movies, and says it would be just as gritty in Judea during this time that the Romans were there.
Jesus's hair is a little too clean for me, at least at the beginning. Like, I'm very well coiffed there. But the thing that I like is that when Scorsese was thinking about making this into a movie, and he had the idea of doing a gospel film, you know, or a Jesus film, a religious film, since he was a kid, basically, he was very influenced by The Robe. When he saw that, it really kind of, you know, took the scales from his eyes. And he really wanted to do this kind of rough and tumble, like Lower East Side kind of a Jesus film. And then when he saw Pasolini's Gospel According to Matthew, he's like, oh, well, there goes my idea. Somebody else already did this. They did this kind of working man Jesus kind of an idea. But it stuck with him for so long. And, you know, Barbara Hershey had given him a copy of The Last Temptation all the way back with Boxcar Bertha, which he made for Corman. And that stuck with him. He wanted to do this, and he tried for so long. And in 1983, it looked like, hey, this thing might actually happen. And then the floor completely fell out on him.
And that's the thing about the 1983 production. There's several books that you can read related to The Last Temptation of Christ. The one that I remember reading was Scorsese on Scorsese, all those director interview books that came out years ago. And in 1983, Paramount had given him the green light. They already had sets built. They were ready to go. They were about a week out from production. Aidan Quinn was originally Jesus. Barbara Hershey and Harvey Keitel were still in their roles. And instead of David Bowie as pilot, it was going to be Sting at the time. And there was a huge letter writing campaign that came out supposedly out of a leaked script. And at the time, you have to remember 1983, this was the early rise of the moral majority. People like Jerry Falwell and things like that who had gotten Ronald Reagan elected in 1980. So there was this big push in the early 1980s and in the late 70s where you had the rise of fundamentalist Christianity in America. And through their letter writing campaign, they basically stopped the production just literally days before it was supposed to go before the cameras. And it died, but Scorsese was still working on it and realized, as he said on the commentary and if you read in the interviews, that really the only way to do it would be to scale it back even further. And he cut the budget even further in 1987 when Universal gave him the go-ahead to do it. But he was smart this time because he had co-production with Cineplex Odeon, which at least he knew that they would go into the Cineplex Odeon theaters at the time if no one else was going to show it. So everyone who worked on it did it basically for free or next to nothing. And as you'll hear with our interview with cinematographer Michael Bauhaus about his experience on it, it was a great experience of just working fast and doing all this great stuff that you could do at the time. And I have to say, you know, it was a great chance to talk to him about sort of what he learned working from Fassbinder, who made so many films so fast. I mean, Fassbinder had only worked for 12 years and did like 40 films. And to work with Martin Scorsese and what he was able to bring from working with Fassbinder into this collaboration with Martin Scorsese and, of course, all the ones that he's done with him since.
I read Thomas Lindoff's book, Hollywood Under Siege, Martin Scorsese, The Religious Right and the Culture Wars. And in there, they talk about this whole idea of scaling it back and that Scorsese was so desperate to do this at the time that, yeah, he took like a $20 million budget, cut it down to like $7 million, and he goes, you know what? I'll even direct the sequel to Flashdance.
Oh man.
Which I can only imagine that alternate history. You know, you talked about this letter writing campaign, and they quote some of the letters in this Lindoff book, and like misinformation is great, and I love this whole idea of rumors kind of propagating and just kind of repeating themselves and stuff. And it was as if people had gotten The Last Temptation of Christ confused with this Danish film that had been made a few years prior. I believe it goes by several different titles, but there's one, I Saw Jesus Die was one of the titles. And in that, Jesus is just this kind of, he is definitely a very earthy Jesus, let's say. And he has sex with Mary Magdalene, has a homosexual relationship with John. That somehow got transmuted with The Last Temptation of Christ, and there became in that letter writing campaign this whole idea of, we don't want to see a homosexual Jesus. And that was nowhere in The Last Temptation, the book, the screenplay. You know, there was one line about when John the Baptist kisses Jesus, he kisses him on the mouth, and Jesus thinks to himself like his tongue was as hot as coal or something. But that's as close to it. I mean, we don't have him fornicating with Judas or, you know, like, hey, Thomas, you know, do you doubt how sexy I am? There's none of that kind of stuff. So it was weird the way that these letters all kind of had the same stuff to them. You know, there must have been like a master letter that got sent out to these different churches and people just copied from that.
Well, it was probably the case, because a lot of times when there's letter writing campaigns, there is a lot of formula letters. The other thing is that with this film, it's not like they didn't have source material to go to.
Yeah.
If anyone had gone back and actually looked at the book, as you said, it is kind of a slog, but if they would have went back and looked at it, they would have understood what he was trying to accomplish. But then again, if you are trying to whip people up into a frenzy, you know, giving them actual information instead of, you know, false information usually helps, or the other way around.
There were quite a few things that people did find controversial. One of them, and I'll go, I guess, like minor to major, one of them was Jesus's reaction to his mother at one point when he is faced with her and he doesn't recognize her. Jesus can't reject his mother. What the hell is going on? You can't do that. Jesus loves his mom. Come on. You can take that as everyone around him has rejected him and he's finally given himself over to God, and so thus he has no earthly family. That's my interpretation of it. But there, you know, you can interpret that in different ways. Then the other one, the next biggest one, this is really where the rubber met the road when it came to Last Temptation, is the whole idea of Jesus is up on the cross and an angel comes to him, a guardian angel, who says,
remember when he told Abraham to sacrifice his son? Abraham was just about to kill the boy with his knife when God stopped him. So if he saved Abraham's son, don't you think he'd want to save his own? He's tested you and he's happy with you. He doesn't want your blood. He said, let him die in a dream, but let him live his life.
All the pain, that was real.
Yes, but there won't be any more. You've done enough.
You can have Mary Magdalene. You can pursue everybody's life that they want to pursue, you don't have to die on the cross. And Jesus says, okay, yeah, all right, great. I've proven myself. I'm finally free of this torture. You know, I've given myself over to God. And he said that that was enough. And so he pursues his life. There's a scene where he has sex with Mary Magdalene. I'd say what? It's what, 20 seconds long? You don't even see like a butt or a boob.
The whole last half hour of that, what you're talking about, which I call the last temptation, that is the film, is where it really diverts from the gospel, is to me the interesting what if. It's sort of like reading those historical novels, sort of like what if Hitler would have won World War II, or what if the South would have won the Civil War. And basically what Kazantzakis gives us is a glimpse of what life would have been like for this person if they just would have went on with their lives and not been the historical person and the savior that people wanted him to be and is for them. So that's a fascinating thing. And I can understand why that can be controversial for people.
I love the part in that Last Temptation sequence, we'll call it, since it's a group of scenes, when he meets up with Paul of Tarsus, formerly known as Saul. And Paul is up there telling his whole story about the road to Damascus and when he was blinded by the light of God and all this. And the way that Paul tells it is basically the way that Paul tells it. The whole idea of Jesus was crucified, he died for our sins, he came back 3 days later, yada, yada, yada. And it's like, okay, well, did that really happen? Or is that the way that this guy is interpreting what happened? And, you know, basically tells him,
look around you, look at all these people. Look at their faces. Do you see how unhappy they are? Do you see how much they're suffering? Their only hope is the resurrected Jesus. I don't care whether you're Jesus or not. The resurrected Jesus will save the world, and that's what matters.
Those are lies. You can't save the world by lying.
I created the truth out of what people needed and what they believed. If I have to crucify you to save the world, then I'll crucify you. And if I have to resurrect you, then I'll do that too, whether you like it or not.
I won't let you. I'll tell everyone the truth.
Go ahead. Tell them now. Who's going to believe you? You started all this. Now you can't stop it. All those people who believe me will grab you and kill you.
No, that wouldn't happen.
How do you know? You see, you don't know how much people need God. You don't know how happy he can make them. He can make them happy to do anything. You make them happy to die, and they'll die. All for the sake of Christ. Jesus Christ. Jesus of Nazareth. The Son of God. The Messiah. Not you. Not for your sake. You know, I'm glad I met you. Because now I can forget all about you. My Jesus is much more important and much more powerful. Thank you. It's a good thing, I mean.
And it is that same thing that I was just talking about, the way that misinformation gets propagated. It's just like, basically, this is the story I'm telling, and this is the story that we're going to go with. So take it, and you better deal with it.
In a way, this scene almost sort of mirrored for me the idea of going to kind of your own funeral and hearing your own life story, like, after the fact. And sort of like Willem Dafoe's Jesus has this opportunity to sort of see what happens after his story comes out. And in a way, I saw it as not only a meditation or an idea on why the story is powerful for people. And even if it's not true, 100% history true, it still matters to people. And that's what I found really interesting. And that at the same time, that even in its lack of truth, there is a truth for people within it. So that, and sort of how would someone who was there, the actual person that was there, sort of go, you know, no, you know, and what you look at now when you see, I don't care if it's a political philosophy or religious philosophy or anything like that, how things continue to mutate, how stories continue to mutate. It's like a long game of telephone, you know, when you were a kid and they would put one kid at one side of the room and say, okay, say this message to the next kid. And by the time you get to the other side of the room, the message has changed.
I just saw a hilarious cartoon the other day. It was Jesus sitting on a stone and he's got the apostles around him. He's like, listen carefully, because I don't want you guys to tell this four different ways. I like what you're saying. And it reminds me kind of It's a Wonderful Life in reverse. Rather than, hey, everything would have been so horrible had George Bailey died. Basically, in this version, it was he sees like the destruction of Jerusalem and all these horrible things going on. And it's just like, you know, no. You should have died back then.
As for the crucifixion, which we see sort of in two halves, we see him crucified, and as you talked about, the angel comes and takes him from the cross, and he lives this, you know, about 30 minutes of, you know, his life, and he perpetually ages and then becomes an old man. And then at the very end, we see him back up on the cross again. Is that crucifixion scene is amazing. If you're going to watch a film and see that, if you're going to watch a Christ-centered film and see the crucifixion, I think Martin Scorsese does an amazing job in making you feel it. And he gives you echoes of it, like as we were talking about in the early part where he's making the cross, because there's this echo of him carrying the cross through the streets for the person who's going to be crucified. And then we see sort of echoes of same shot selection, different, you know, sort of image ideas and things like that within that first crucifixion that later play themselves out within his own. So it's sort of a mirroring. But it's so well done, and it's not over the top like it had been done in other places, and we'll talk about that later.
Talking about the whole idea of the familiarity of the story and everything, and that we are hitting these certain beats throughout that middle part, you know, I love the way that Schrader kind of crafted this screenplay, and Jay Cox helped out Scorsese in the later drafts of it and everything, and just the way that we have, like you said, the echoes of these different things going on, the repetition of some of these images and everything, and just the way that they kind of pared down those stories from the Gospels and gave you which ones did they hit? What were the important things? And also, you know, we do have these four Gospels, which a lot of people, you know, are still under the wrong impression that those were written like while Jesus was still walking around. It's like, you know, oh yeah, tonight, today, Jesus did this. You know, like they go back to their cave and write, you know, in Aramaic. It's like, no, sorry, these were written in Greek a few, you know, decades and maybe a century afterwards. Anyway, so we have these four different versions, and it almost, you know, we always have the conflict of what happens in the gospel, and then to see the conflict in Jesus himself. I mean, there are scenes where it's like Jesus is rushing in, he's going to do something, he suddenly changes his mind. It's almost like we see that conflict of the page right there on the screen and in the person of Jesus himself.
So we did talk a little bit about the cast on this earlier. And I have to say, I've talked to some friends of mine who have seen the film, and they don't appreciate it because they don't like the sound of the film. And what I mean by that is the vocal.
She works on the Sabbath. She goes with Romans on the Sabbath. She broke Moses' law. She dies.
All of the Jews are Americans or they're New York City sounding people. Keitel obviously sounds like he's from New York. Some of the other folks that are in there, I mean, even the minor cast. I mean, you have John Lurie in there, Victor Argo in there. Andre Gregory, I mean, it's just an amazing cast of people. And to have the Jews being Americans and then the Romans as Brits is kind of a change compared to what we're expecting within usual biblical epics.
It reminds me of more like wartime films where the bad guys may be German, but they tend to speak with a British accent. You know, Americans are Americans and anybody else speaks with a British accent. And personally, I don't really mind Keitel as Judas. I think the first time I saw it, I was a little taken aback. Like, whoa, this guy sounds kind of different than everybody else on screen, not just the Romans, but even his fellow, you know, Jews. I was just like, whoa, this guy, you know, sounds a little different. And it's funny that, like, he was nominated for a Razzie that year. And it's like, I just don't see it as being that bad of a performance, especially at the end when he comes in and finally accuses Jesus as being a traitor to the cause. It's like very, to me anyway, a very powerful performance, and I can get past the vocals fairly easily.
Traitor!
Your place was on the cross. That's where God put you. When death got too close, you got scared and you ran away and hid yourself in the life of some man. We did what we were supposed to do. You didn't. You're a coward.
I guess it's sort of like a jazz player. I mean, you have a saxophonist and he can hit certain rhythms or certain tones and from album to album. And when you listen to Keitel's delivery in certain parts in this film, and then you hear him also in his performance in Reservoir Dogs, it's almost to the beat, just the way it sounds.
Yeah, at least he didn't start to howl in this one, because for a little while, like between Reservoir Dogs and The Bad Lieutenant, yeah, he was howling quite a bit in his films.
And I love David Bowie in here because he's not David Bowie. Like, if you didn't know it was him, you wouldn't know.
You would think it was Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, it's great. And the other thing that's interesting about Bowie in terms of the lines that he has is as he's talking to Willem Dafoe, you know, Jesus, and he says, look, you know.
We have a space for you up on Golgotha. 3,000 skulls there by now. Probably more. I do wish you people would go out and count them sometime. Maybe you'd learn a lesson. No. Probably not.
You get this humanist portrait of Pilate too, where it's not, he's not, he just has to take, he has to do the job, and he just doesn't want to, he doesn't want to crucify people. That's what I got to do, I guess.
Let's talk a little bit about the music in this, because the score is remarkable. Even on its own, it stands, it is so good.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Gabriel does a great job with this, the Passion album soundtrack, and just sort of his mix of finding all of these different elements of Middle Eastern music, Indian music. It in a way kind of reminds me of it. I know it's going to be an odd comparison because that's more electronic, kind of like what you hear at times in Blade Runner, where you have sort of these ethnic music pieces in there. And I think that Peter Gabriel takes it one notch further in terms of hiring all of these really amazing sort of people from all over the world to be on the soundtrack. And this and Natural Born Killers, I'd have to say probably Natural Born Killers first, because I think I saw that first, was where I was introduced to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who's a Pakistani Qawwali singer. And he is the one that you hear on the Passion Peter Gabriel soundtrack for Last Temptation, who's hitting those really high notes, those really high like vocal pieces. And he just has an amazing voice. And he died about a decade or so ago, but his music is just incredible. And the thing that's interesting about Qawwali music within Pakistan, as you know, Pakistan is a religious country. And the only time that you can have music is for celebration, for religious celebration. All the music is religious. So they would have these massive concerts where Nusrat and his group would play, and they would play for like 5-6 hours nonstop, like these constant jams. Yeah. And he just had this big voice. And it's my understanding that within his family, within the Khan family, their legacy of being Qawwali singers within the tradition in Pakistan and in that area in northern India goes back to about the 1600s. It was sort of something that was passed down generation to generation.
Yeah, another interesting thing about Qawwali music is it's a Q word that doesn't have a U.
There you go. So there's you can win your trivia contest.
Exactly. So we're going to take a break and play back interviews with the cinematographer of The Last Temptation of Christ, Michael Ballhaus, and
Nikos Kazantzakis,
scholar, Professor Darren Middleton.
Hello, I'm Mugumbo, and I am a potaholic. I have been known to consume 4 or 5 of these underground commentaries a day, salivating for the next episodes. I have tweeted the creators of these shows and offered sexual favors for validation and conversation. I put these hosts high on a pedestal, but for some reason, I can never climax until I listen to the Traumatic Cinematic Show. What is the difference, you ask? The Traumatic Cinematic Show has my own self-defecating voice on it. Nothing gets me off faster than thinking about myself. So when you are sitting around nude, pleasuring yourself to the voices of strangers, check out TraumaticCinematic.com, because we'll give you a reach around. You can also find us on TraumaticCinematic.podomatic.com.
I'm on the internet!
Here at Single Simulcast, we often think about our listeners, what you're feeling, what your emotions are.
How much there is a show that I could depend on?
Every Wednesday, Single Simulcast will bring you some of the liveliest, funniest podcasts that you've ever heard, with such things as skits, musical interludes, and parody songs.
I wish there was a show that I could laugh at.
We here at Single Simulcast fully support you and your visions and dreams, so we will never do anything but bring you the most hilarious storylines in the game today.
I wish I could fly.
Single Simulcast loves you, and we want you to know that we will always be funny, except for now, because we're being serious. Serious about being funny.
I wish I had a wish star like Macaulay Culkin.
That's Single Simulcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Zune, and at www.singlesimulcast.com. Single Simulcast. If you don't know by now, then you're probably slipping.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
You've worked a lot with Martin Scorsese. Can you talk about how you first met him and started working with him here in the States?
Yes. I have to go back one step. I was a big fan of his work, and I remember when he came to Berlin to show Raging Bull, he was standing there, this little guy in front of, in the movie theater, a big movie theater, and I said to my wife, with this guy, I would love to make a movie one day. And I could have said to her, I want to fly to the moon. It was too far away. That it was almost the same. And then a couple of years later, it was like 2 or 3 years later, I got a phone call, and he was on the line and said, I would love to shoot with you Last Temptation of Christ, and would you want to do that? And I was so excited that I couldn't sleep for 3 nights. And then I met him on his birthday in November, and in L.A., and we talked a lot, and it was wonderful talking to him, and I was in heaven. And at that time, it was the production of Universal and was supposed to be shot in Israel, and the budget was $20 million. So I got my deal memo, and I went to Israel and looked at all the locations and looked at the costumes, and it was big. Everything was big. There was like a big Titan crane there already, and there were 3,000 costumes made already and all that. And I got a little scared, I must say, because I have never shot a movie that size. You know, the biggest movie I shot in Germany was like 6 million, but not 20. And then I came back home to Berlin, and a couple of weeks later, they pulled the plug because the moral majority said, if this movie is in the movie theaters, then the movie theaters will burn. So they got really cold feet and pulled the plug. And then it took Marty, I guess, took him almost 4 or 5 years to get it rejuvenated. And then the budget was not 20 million, but 7. And we all did it as a work of love for Marty, because we all knew that this is one of his favorite projects. And it was wonderful because it was a poor movie. We didn't have money. It was Jesus was a poor guy, and everything was right for the time when Jesus lived, and the other one was a big Hollywood movie. So I was very happy that we did it this way and not the other way.
That's interesting. I didn't know that you were originally in discussions to do, I think it was the 83 version, the original version, and you know, when it got canceled, I mean, what were your thoughts? I mean, had you ever had a film canceled because of protests?
No. And for me was, I fell in a deep, deep hole and thought, oh God, I'll never see this guy again, and it's going to be terrible. And I was in heaven, and then I fell down from heaven pretty hard, came back to earth. I was really desperate. Because to meet him and have the chance to work with him once was fantastic. But then, 2 years later, I had the chance, and that was a much better start for me when I shot After Hours with him. Because After Hours was a poor movie, again, it was 4 million, and Marty had shot his movie before that, it was 20 million, and it was not a success, unfortunately. And so a producer came to Marty and said, look, we have, Marty hadn't worked for 5 years. And they said, okay, this is a small budget and it's only 4 million. And he liked the story and he wanted to work and do it. And then he made a shot list like he always does, and it was 600 shots. And the producer said to him, Marty, can you do that in 40 nights? And he said, ask Michael. Then they came to me, and I looked at it and made my homework and met Marty again and said, Marty, look, we have to do 16 shots every night. Can you do it? And he said, okay, let's try together, then we can do it. And to make a long story short, he got all his 600 shots. And we finished on time, and we came in on the budget. And it was, for me, it was the greatest experience to work with a guy like him under these conditions, because I could do it because I'd done it, you know, with Fassbinder and others in Germany. And then on the end, he said, you had taught me that you can do it another way, and just not the Hollywood way, but more the European way. And that was great, and that was the beginning of our wonderful, long journey. And, you know, and it was the greatest thing for me to work with Marty. And I wish I had shot all the movies in this time, but then other directors came and said, who is this new guy? Wanted to work with me.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think After Hours is really underappreciated when we talk about, you know, the films that Marty's done. I mean, it's kind of, people forget that he even did that. It's sort of overshadowed by other stuff, but it's such a great film. And it's interesting, you were talking about how he learned something from you, and I was going to ask, you know, sort of as the DP, what do you see as the difference in the process between, you know, obviously you did all those films for Fassbinder, and now you've done probably as many with Marty. What do you see as the difference in their process and what you've learned from both of them in that way?
What I learned from them, I mean, what I learned from Fassbinder is that you have to be very fast. If you want to be good, you have to be really well prepared. You have to think about the scene. You have to make sure that you know exactly the location, that you know the actors, that you really are into the story, that you know what this is about, and then be ahead of the game. And when he came in and made his suggestions for the shots and all that, then you are prepared. Then you know, okay, this is the way he sees it. And that was the way we worked together. And it was funny, he didn't like to go to a location because he was always bored when he knew already where the scene was taking place. So I had to go there with a production manager. And then he came on the morning and said, okay, what do you think? What should we do? And then I always had an idea. I told him. And then he thought about a moment about it and came up with a better idea. And so I learned from him every time when he asked me that, and I had an idea, he always was better. So we both became better because I learned from him, and he had to be better then. So it was funny. It was always a game. And on the end, we were so far together in a way that we didn't have to talk much about some things, because I knew already, okay, he would go this way and that way. And then it was fun, but, you know, it was, most of the time it was fun working with him. The problem was when he was playing his games with people, and he did that. He was very mean and played his games.
As for the working style between him and Marty, what do you see as how Marty works?
Marty is in a way totally different, than Fassbinder. They have one thing in common. They all have a vision about the look of a film, and they always have images in their head. And with Marty, it was so that Marty was normally really extremely well prepared. He worked like 3 months before a movie starts on a shot list, and really had thought out like every shot, extremely very, very special shots and wonderful angles and all that. And when I got his shot list and looked at it, I was always fascinated by his fantasy. But he is, Marty is, okay, he's not, also not the easiest director in the world, but we had a great, great relationship. He was never, ever mean to me. He was very friendly, very open. and I had a wonderful time with him. And so that was totally different, much more, when I say relaxed, that's not the right word, because with Marty you're never relaxed because he's very tense. I liked him very much. I adored him, and he felt it, and I understand his vision and tried to retranslate it into real images, and that worked pretty well. So it was, with him working was just great.
So in 82, 83, you get offered Last Temptation. It gets canceled. You work on After Hours and Color of Money, and then Last Temptation comes around again. Let's kind of go back to the beginning. When you first read the script and he offered it to you, what was it about Last Temptation that made it exciting as something you wanted to work on?
First of all, I liked this story by Nikos Kantzakis, this writer who had this idea about Jesus and his life, and that the turning point on the end when he's hanging on the cross, that he is not dead, that he is still alive and lives a life like a other human being. And there are theories, as you probably know, that Jesus didn't die on the cross, that his friends healed him, and then he went to India, and there is still a place in India where they pretend that this is the place where he is buried. So this is, you know, a story that he just picked up, this Nikos Kantzakis. It was fascinating to look at his life in a different way, and then to shoot the movie in that period of time that was so poor. And and we had also an incredible, wonderful actor that I loved. And so it was, and then again, I must say, we had problems with the weather. We had problems with the schedule. But whenever we had a problem, like once it was raining like crazy, and the river we had was not a river anymore, but like a stream, like you couldn't shoot there anymore because the water was like 1 meter higher or 2 meters higher than before. But we found a better location. Or they had like a location for the last scene for the crucifixion. And and because we went this from August to December, we finished the movie like 2 days before Christmas, and it was cold there on the mountains. It was already snow. So you couldn't shoot the crucifixion in snow because, you know, Jesus hanging there, that's not funny. So we found a location that was better. So I always felt that we got help from above, that it always went was better than it was planned. And that was a great feeling to feel that I am that way, that I think we got some help.
That's the thing I talk to local filmmakers here in the Detroit area about, is that, you know, if you're doing a big film, you can just throw money at the problem. But when you don't have a lot of money, you got to get creative. And
yes,
with this one, like you said, the budget was more than cut in half. You said it was originally 20. It was down to about $7 million. And to try and do the film from a visual aspect, I mean, what were you looking at? Were you looking at other films that had done Jesus in that time period, or were you looking to something else to try and figure out visually how the film should look?
No, I think we didn't look at other movies that were done, because most of them, I don't even remember that there are movies about his life before. No, it wasn't that. We had the fact that we had 40 days. We had more than 40 days. 40 days was we had more than 40 days. I think we had 60 days, but you had to look at the location. What can you do with the location? At what time to shoot it? What was the best time to shoot a scene? Because most of it was exterior day, or, you know, it's very little artificial light, or very little, not too many scenes that were shot inside. And because it was all like fire or candlelight or things like that. And then you just go as close as possible to the storytelling. And we had great locations, and it was we really were working hard. We left our hotel when it was dark in the morning, arrived on the set, and when the sun came up, the camera started rolling. And when the sun went down, the camera was still rolling. But when it got too dark, then we had to stop. And then we went home, slept a couple of hours, and did the same again. But it was fulfilling because it was great spirit between all of them. It was wonderful. It was great.
I believe you shot, what was it, in North Africa? Is that correct?
No, in Morocco.
And how was it in Morocco? How did you find it as a place to do a production? Because I don't know if you've ever shot in such a place before.
No, I haven't shot in Morocco before, but it was, at that time, it was pretty primitive. They didn't have much equipment at all. We could fly in everything or brought in everything from Germany. And the crew was not very good. The crew came from Italy, and the producer, his wife at that time, was not so great. She was very gritty and, you know, like penny pitching and things like that. But still, it was okay. It was okay, and we just enjoyed it. And but again, you had to be really well prepared to get it done. So I had to look and look and say, okay, so we shoot this scene in this direction in the morning, and then we turn the camera around and shoot the other part in the evening, because then the sun was right for the morning light, and when we turned around, it was good for the evening. So, but you have always to think about exactly where the sun coming up, where it's going down, and think about every detail to don't mix it up. And that was, and we had a wonderful production designer, Dante Ferretti, was doing it, and he is a genius, and I love him. And so it was fantastic.
As for the cast, what was it like working with, you know, Willem Dafoe and Harvey Keitel and those people?
I mean, I think they were all great. Willem, I like very much. He's a brilliant, brilliant actor. And Marty was looking a lot for the right guy to play this part, but Willem really got so much into the part that he was... it was not method acting like with Danny DeLewis. He didn't tell he was Jesus. That was not the way he was acting. But he was very much into the spirit of this character. And the other actors, they were all great, wonderful actors. Mary Magdalene was wonderful. She was great. And I think the whole spirit of this was, it was the life of a fantastic human being, if you like to say that Jesus was human. Yes, he was. And that inspired all of us in a way. And the way when you see his speaking or preaching or doing things, it was an incredible experience, I must say.
How much did sort of the fact that it had been shut down before kind of play in, that there was this sort of defiant, I mean, I want to feel that maybe there was a defiant spirit, that the people are like, we're going to do this even though people don't want us to do this, you know, and we're going to do it the best we can with what we have. I mean, I mean, I know for me, if I was making it, that's the kind of attitude I would take in.
Yeah, so that was our attitude also. We said, we have to do it for this money. This is all we have. And, you know, we only had, you know, in Israel we had like 2,000 extras, and here we had like 200, or maybe not even 200. Sometimes we had 100 and make things look like a lot.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.